Hello and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Senek, joined as always by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, Impeachment Revisited. And for our audience, if you haven't already, I'd recommend to our listeners last week's podcast where we first took up the issue of the Democrats in the House moving towards an impeachment inquiry for President Trump. The genesis of this, just to review, is in the whistleblower complaint alleging that in a phone call with the new Ukrainian president, President Trump had crossed some lines. The allegation goes by requesting that they investigate corruption allegations around Hunter Biden, Joe Biden's son, who was on the board of Ukrainian Energy Company. There were also suggestions that the White House may have been conditioning Ukrainian military aid on that work, though we still haven't really seen anything to substantiate that yet. So, Richard, let me start you with this. When we taped the last show, we knew the general thrust of this complaint, and we had just seen, right before we taped, the White House's transcript of the call. The one big material change since then is that we now also have the whistleblower's complaint having been made public. And that document also included allegations that the White House had tried to cover up the substance of this conversation by moving the readout of the call, for instance, to a different digital location than it would be normally stored. On last week's episode, you were pretty unambiguous in saying that the Democrats had no real case against the president here. Anything in the text of that whistleblower complaint or anything else that has happened in the last week that has changed your thinking about that?
Well, the whistleblowers can't release is a two-edged sword. On the one hand, you can say that what it does is it strengthens the situation, but if you actually kind of look reasonably closely at it, then look at what the inspector general said about the particular source, and what it does is it surely weakens the case. I mean, the first point to note, as best one can say, the only piece of evidence that the whistleblower looked to, which was the basis of this report, was the July 25th telephone call. If that is already out, it counts as best evidence, and somebody else's summary of it essentially is his private views, but should never be able to displace what's going on. The second thing, of course, that's extremely dicey about this situation are the two levels of hearsay. This fellow reports to hear from many individuals. You don't know who these individuals are. You don't know whether or not they were, in fact, in breach of their own duties of confidentiality inside the White House. You have no way to question them to see whether or not they're actually telling the truth. We do know that Trump is not particularly popular with all sorts of longtime civil servants in the State Department and elsewhere in the government, and some of them can simply be taking this particular opportunity to chase after him. Somebody's going to say, well, we can deny that. It's okay for you to deny it, but the only way in which you can do this stuff is to make it available. There is a very strong rule with respect to ordinary trials, and Lord knows whether these apply to impeachment-type cases, that if a declarant is available, then you cannot use somebody else who summarizes that person's views in order to get him across, because what you're doing is you're depriving people on the other side of two things. One, the right to cross-examine these people, and two, the right to investigate them to see whether or not there's some other kinds of information that they've had, which if made public, would in fact change the particular credibility. And I think, in effect, it is irresponsible to try to base something like this on unsubstantiated hearsay. But it's a double hearsay, because they have still not revealed the identity of the party who has made these particular allegations. So we don't know whether he was acting consistent with his obligations, or whether or not, notwithstanding the obvious piety with which he writes, that he was in breach of his confidentiality situation. So he's not a national hero unless you regard Edward Snowden as a national hero. And that is, of course, extremely difficult, because you can't cross-examine him about the people whom he wants to tell you. And this is a case in which that kind of information, as with the independent investigation, will really make it because of the matter. The third thing about this, which makes it even worse, is it turns out the inspector general said, it appears credible. The word appears has to be underlined and stressed. And then he announced it's pretty clear that this guy had political bias in favor of some other candidate. But he doesn't talk anything about those particulars. He just lets it sit there. And so what you want to do is to say, who was the candidate? What were the source of the political bias? At this particular point, if you're trying to establish a predisposition on bias, when you put this guy on the stand, as it were, what you're entitled to do is to go back through the entire record to see exactly what it was that led the inspector general to say that this was a case of political bias. So the point about this is the pattern that they're trying to introduce against this fellow, against Trump, is a one-off. It's just on this conversation. But what goes on the other side is a very much larger and more complicated type situation. And the final point, which we just found out this today, was it turns out that this guy decided to give this thing to Adam Schiff, who is the Democratic head on the House side with respect to these intelligence issues, before making it available to anybody else. And that simply confirms the bias charge, and it also makes it quite clear that Mr. Schiff himself should never have received that information, or if he had received that information, he immediately should have shared it with his Republican counterpart inside the House of Representatives. This has a very eerie resemblance to the situation when Dianne Feinstein got this anonymous message from Christine Blasey Ford and did not share it with the chairman of the committee at that time, the senator from Grassley, the senator from Iowa. So the whole thing at this point starts to stink. And then the question is, given all of these kinds of differences, how do you then base this as a case? I mean, compare this to Watergate. Was that based on double hearsay by biased witnesses? I mean, the whole point about it is impeachment in every single case has to proceed on an agreed record of facts about which you then try to draw inferences. So everybody agreed that Bill Clinton lied with respect to what he said under the deposition. Some people said it mattered, some people said it didn't matter, but there weren't factual credibility issues. Richard Nixon, all the facts were perfectly clear at the time. This case, everything is contested. And there's just no way in my mind that you can think of an impeachment process that can possibly work if credibility of all of these witnesses are going to be at stake. How are you going to run a cross-examination? Remember, you don't have a normal trial where there's a prosecutor and a defense lawyer. You've got 100 senators sitting there asking questions. Well, that's not the way to do anything like this. What you have to do is put some of these people on the stand, and you may have to grill them for hours in order to figure out what's going on. So the format doesn't work. There are no rules governing it. Mike Mukasey wrote a very nice article about all of this stuff in the Wall Street Journal saying how it is terra incognita in the way in which you put this together. And so what happens is I regard this as simply incomprehensible, both the spin on the substance and the tolerance for procedural abuses. There's a rule, and I'll just end on this point, is when you're talking about a question like this, you always have to ask, when do you want rules of civil procedure or criminal procedure to apply? And the answer is, in cases that are non-controversial, you want them, but not that much. The time you really want these rules is when everybody is hell-bent for leather to try to get around them, because it's only the procedural safeguards that give you any shot at getting at some kind of a fair trial and at the truth. Justice Frankfurter said that a long time ago. This thing is going to make the Star Chamber, if the Democrats go ahead with this, look as though it was a church picnic.
Let's talk about the subpoenas that have begun being issued from Congress. Both Rudy Giuliani and Mike Pompeo have been resistant to these on somewhat different grounds. Pompeo announced that he and his State Department subordinates wouldn't show up because this was an attempt to essentially bully the State Department. Giuliani, who we should remember is not actually a government employee, he's President Trump's personal lawyer here, has suggested in his case, attorney-client privilege might be at stake. So how much power does Congress have here to compel these appearances? How much power do they have to compel the release of the kind of information they're looking for from these two?
Well, you take it. I think with respect to Pompeo, I think he's on pretty strong ground. I mean, what you'd have to do normally in order to get some court to issue a subpoena, sort of coerce him, is to give some credible grounds on which this would be said. At this particular point, the only thing that they can say about him is he was in attendance at the time that a conversation took place between Zelensky on the one hand and Trump, as were probably 20 other people on both sides together. The mere fact that there are so many people in there make it very difficult for one to think that there was some hush-hush conversation going on, some illicit request. Everything was on the record. Everybody was listening. And I think, in effect, what you have to do is to show something above and beyond that. And what they're starting to do is to kind of make fantasy allegations. Well, he should have spoken up when it was quite clear that Trump was going to threaten him with something if he didn't go after Biden. But, of course, this thing wasn't a threat. It was a love set. And, by the way, what Trump said was true. one has to remember. The Biden did boast about that. And, you know, he's a cocky so-and-so when he did it, saying how he bullied this particular guy. We don't know whether he was the good guy or the bad guy, and I don't want to judge that. But it certainly, Trump was right that he was bragging. And it was also the case that Hunter, his son, was getting $50,000 a month at this particular point of time. And why is that anybody who is close to the administration should be taking job from a Ukrainian company, let alone one that may be in the midst of a political struggle, is just completely inappropriate. And, you know, trying to find out what's going on, at the bottom it was fine. And that's what he said. Can you find out what the world is happening on this? Well, a president who has to conduct foreign affairs, and it turns out that there is now complicated interactions between what American citizens are doing abroad and the influence of foreign nations on domestic policy, clearly they have to talk to everybody else. There was no question that when Mueller ran his reports, there were no kinds of limitations there, except the ones that they self-imposed. And it turned out when you actually got to the hearing, the man was barely coherent, and it was kind of sad. And he managed somehow or other to say, I have the power to deal with things that are related to this, but I'm not going to even look at any of the allegations relating to the Steele dossier, all of which could implicate right up to Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. And yet, somehow or other, they didn't do this. So the Democrats, I think, are really kind of crazy about this. They don't want their people investigated at all, but they're willing to investigate somebody else. And there's a huge difference between essentially a phone conversation that you can see and all sorts of hidden events and multiple interactions involving continents and people and several months of interactions and behavior. One of them you really do have to investigate. The other one I suggest to Mr. Schiff, before he accuses the president basically of committing treason, which is kind of what he said, he's basically refused to honor his obligations to put the defense of the United States first, or to read what it was said, because the only thing we had there is these two guys love one another and they're going to buy more of our missiles, and there were no promises made about any other kind of aid and no other requests that were going on. They're trying to treat pressuring, which was the word that the analyst used, the guy who did not even have a transcript of the conversation when he did it, when in fact, if you read it, this is, looks like a stroking love fest between two guys who are basically trying to make sure that they kind of establish a warm and fuzzy feeling for each other to deal with things going forward. And, you know, Trump is like that. He's a big bear of a man. When he wants to hug you, he can hug you. He's a big bear of the man. And when he wants to claw you, he can claw you. He wasn't clawing in this case. He was hugging.
What about this question with Giuliani? The assertion that attorney-client privilege might be endangered if he's compelled to appear.
The answer is he, as ever, is very imprecise. Let's be careful what the attorney-client privilege covers. It only covers communications between a president and his lawyer about things that pertain to the differences. So there is no attorney-client privilege to the extent that there is any communication to a third party in which Giuliani engages on his own stuff. That is something which you can do and talk about it because it doesn't deal with the question of confidentiality. If somebody wants to then ask him the question, okay, you did this, were you authorized by the president to do it? Then on that question, the attorney-client privilege would do that. But if you think that this is going to give you a per se defense, that would be wrong. The question then you have to ask is, there are other requirements of some kind of a subpoena. And one of the things I gather is the case, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that while he was pumping out hot air, which Trump wants to do, since July of that date, neither Giuliani nor Bill Barr nor anybody else, I guess, has actually gone and conferred with various Ukrainian officials to deal with anything on this particular issue. Am I wrong about that? I think I'm right, but maybe there's something.
I know you're right about Barr. I don't know what the associated time frame is with Giuliani.
Yeah, we don't. But I don't think there is. Well, I think it's certainly clear that they could ask him, and he cannot claim attorney-client privilege. Did you speak with anybody there? He'd have to answer it. And then, as I said before, and they said, what did Mr. Trump instruct you to do? At that point, he could do this. That is, I think the president, with respect to his own lawyer, has the same kind of attorney-client privilege. In addition, when he's starting to deal with people like Pompeo and so forth, it's not an attorney-client privilege, but certainly executive privilege is something which is generally respected. And the only kinds of times that you see this thing are eroded, as were in the Nixon tapes, where there's so much overwhelming evidence, independent evidence of illegality, that it was pretty clear that that kind of privilege was not going to survive. But this case hasn't gone anything like this. There is no Watergate. There is no burglary. There is no breakup. There is no cover-up. there is a phone call. And Trump, of course, releases, as he should have done, releases the transcript immediately in order to quiet this thing. And then people say, oh, but you kept it concealed. Well, confidentiality is, in fact, the norm with respect to transactions that take place between high people. If you cannot get candor if you're dealing with somebody else, my guess is he probably did check with Zelensky as to whether or not he should do it. If this conversation had contained something which was more embarrassing than saying, well, I don't think that Robert Mueller did a very good job. I mean, it could have created all sorts of stuff. Do remember that after he starts talking about the favors and so forth, what he's really interested in is basically blasting Angela Merkel and Germany for being free riders with respect to defense. And what he's trying to do is to say, we're the guys who defend you. You should look to us and not look to them. This had nothing to do with an investigation of the Democrats. This had to do with the president's constant friction with the key member of NATO, having to do with the amount that the Germans are prepared to do to defend against Russian invasion or some similar kind of threat.
So my final question for you, Donald Trump, Richard, is not known for understatement. He's been pretty outspoken in the past week, and some of the rhetoric that has given some people the vapors. I mean, he said that whoever passes information on to the whistleblower was essentially the equivalent of a spy. He said that Adam Schiff should be tried for treason. He's compared what's happening to him to a coup, and he said that the result of an impeachment could be something like a civil war. Didn't exactly call it a civil war. But so my question for you, given that you think that he's got the better side of this case on the merits, what would you advise him in terms of how to proceed right now, both in terms of how the White House is handling the legal side of this, but also how he's handling the public face of it and the rhetoric?
I've given him the same advice since the day he took office. Shut down the tweet machine. He regards this as essential because he has, I don't know, 60 million followers, and he's trying to get his position out. But what he always forgets is that there are people who disagree with him who hear this, and they will just treat this as a sign of fundamental psychological imbalance and take after him. And it turns out what he does is he feeds his enemy more than he helps himself with respect to his friends. What he ought to do is to hire somebody who's a decent lawyer, not Giuliani, not Mark Casey, which, and none of those guys have the slightest idea of what they're doing, to be his personal lawyer and to make this case in a very meticulous and low-key fashion. Does he have to call Schiff a treason committed? No, I don't think he should do that. On the other hand, I did listen to what it was that Schiff said, and the difference between the Democrats when they tell outright falsehoods and Trump when he just kind of fulminates at the mouth is they are pious, sincere. They actually want you to believe them. Donald Trump has always been a bit of a buffoon, a bit of a theater guy. He doesn't much care whether you believe him or not. But Schiff wanted to make it appear as though there was basically a disregard of the fundamental presidential obligation and the oath of office by not taking care of the defense obligation by entering into cahoots with this particular guy. You know, that is treason, is what he's calling about, aiding and abetting and comforting our enemies could essentially amount to that. He doesn't say it. Obviously, he doesn't mean it. But you could see why Trump would kind of jump to that particular conclusion. But he should shut up. As to a civil war, no, it's not going to be a civil war. He knows as well as I do that, first of all, the Democrats may not even get this impeachment thing through. What they may be doing is aiming for a somewhat different strategy, which is to constantly draw out all of this stuff with respect to subpoenas and so forth until you get sometime into the beginning of next year, at which point they drop it, hoping that they're going to have dirtied the presidents in the beginning and then improve their chances in the campaign. That may be true. It may not be true. But certainly I can't conceive that they can say, okay, we're not going to take anybody's evidence. We're not going to basically, we say, well, if Pompeo doesn't answer us, that means that he's concealing stuff, and then try to give an impeachment device on the grounds that people are refusing to answer their subpoenas. I think what's going to happen is the Democrats will lose the independence in this country. I mean, I cannot stress enough. I read people like Thomas Friedman. They simply find it incapable to tell the truth. They're still saying he asked these guys, he pressured these guys, he was asking for quid pro quos of one sort or another. They take the word favor out of context, and then they put it into the most nefarious way possible. The whistleblower did that. He did not cite a single word in that report from anything that went on because he didn't hear the conversation to support the allegation of pressure. And you listen to that conversation. This is a schmooze fest. This is a love fest. This is not a pressure sense. They weren't playing hardball. So I think, in effect, that the Democrats can't do this quickly. I think some of their moderates are going to lose if Ms. Pelosi forces them to the boat. I think she understands that. Everybody is playing the tapes from 20 years ago where a considerably younger Nancy Pelosi and Gerald Nadler, still both around, in effect, were coursing everybody about the sobriety of the event and not to go after this. And I have to tell you, I thought it was a terrible mistake for the Republicans to begin impeachment proceedings against Bill Clinton. And I thought it was a terrible mistake. I said so at the time when Justice Stevens decided it was okay to let the discovery go forward in these suits having to do with various forms of sexual allegations. I think it was with Paula Jones, but it doesn't really matter. It's just crazy. You have a sitting president. You never put them under oath in a deposition. What you do is you suspend the statute of limitations and you preserve documents. And then you try the case after he's out of office. And I can't understand how Stevens so blundered this question by thinking that discovery was not going to be all that consequential. Any lawyer will tell you that it's not the trial at which you win and lose cases. It's the discovery at which you win and lose cases. Because if you get 99 things right and make one fatal concession, you have lost a particular case. And so they prepare you within an inch of your life so as to make sure you don't make the one fatal slip, which drops you off the edge of a cliff. And if you understand that that's how depositions are prepared for and taken, then you'd never think that this was an inconsequential or unimportant thing, and you would never allow the testimony to go through. So, if you start looking at this case compared to that case, with Clinton, he really did lie. Okay, I just didn't think it was important enough for one-to-one to do all of this stuff. And in the end, he survived it reasonably well. And what hurt him more was the sexual scandal rather than the impeachment case. With Trump, there's absolutely nothing here, as far as I can tell. I'm stupefied at how it is that the Democrats can push this. And I want to again stress, I agree with many of the things that Trump has done substantively. I have the highest admiration for his judges and many of the people in his cabinet and so forth. I think he's a loose cannon. And, you know, starting in January of 2017, I was kind of praying that he would resign. I would never take those charges up again today, because then it would appear that he'd be yielding to improper pressure from the Democrats under these circumstances. And one cannot allow them to have the quarry that they want, given the deplorable way in which they've behaved.
All right. Thank you, Richard. And thank you to our listeners as well. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting Defining Ideas at hoover.org. And you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.